The Intervention of Russia. 1. In his speech to the Reichstag on April 28th, Hitler had omitted his customary attack on the Soviet Union. There was not a word about Russia. Colonel Beck, in his reply, had mentioned various other hints made by Germany, which went much further than the subjects of discussion, and reserved the right to return to this matter if necessary. A veiled but obvious reference to Germany's previous efforts to induce Poland to join the Anti-Comintern Pact against Russia. Though Beck did not know it, nor did Chamberlain, those anti-Russian efforts were now being abandoned. Fresh ideas were beginning to germinate in Berlin and Moscow. It is difficult to ascertain exactly when the first moves were made in the two capitals toward an understanding between Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union, which was to lead to such immense consequences for the world. One of the first slight changes in the wind, as has already been noted, took place as far back as October 3, 1938, 4 days after Munich, when the counselor of the German embassy in Moscow informed Berlin that Stalin would draw certain conclusions from the Sudeten settlement, from which he had been excluded, and might well become more positive toward Germany. The diplomat strongly advocated a wider economic collaboration between the two countries, and renewed his appeal in a second dispatch a week later. Toward the end of October, the German ambassador in Moscow, Friedrich Werner Count von der Schulenburg, notified the German Foreign Office that it was his intention in the immediate future to approach Molotov, the chairman of the Council of the People's Commissars, in an attempt to reach a settlement of the questions disturbing German-Soviet relations. The ambassador would hardly have conceived such an intention on his own, in view of Hitler's previous extremely hostile attitude toward Moscow. The hint must have come from Berlin. That it did becomes clear from a study of the captured Foreign Office archives. The first step, in the German view, was to improve trade between the two countries. A Foreign Office memorandum of November 4, 1938, reveals an emphatic demand from Field Marshal Goering's office at least to try to reactivate our Russian trade, especially insofar as Russian raw materials are concerned. The Russo-German economic agreements expired at the end of the year, and the Wilhelmstrasse files are full of material showing the ups and downs experienced in negotiating a renewal. The two sides were highly suspicious of each other, but were vaguely drawing closer together. On December 22nd, there were lengthy talks in Moscow between Russian trade officials and Germany's crack economic troubleshooter, Julius Schnurrer. Shortly after the new year, the Soviet ambassador in Berlin, Alexei Mirakalov, made one of his infrequent trips to the Wilhelmstrasse to inform it of the Soviet Union's desire to begin a new era in German-Soviet economic relations. And for a few weeks there were promising talks, but by February 1939 they had pretty much broken down, ostensibly over whether the main negotiations should be conducted in Moscow or Berlin. But the real reason was revealed in a memorandum of the director of the Economic Policy Department of the German Foreign Office on March 11, 1939. Though Germany was hungry for Russia's raw materials and Goering was constantly demanding that they be obtained, the Reich simply could not supply the Soviet Union with the goods which would have to be exchanged. The director thought the rupture of negotiations was extremely regrettable in view of Germany's raw materials position. But if the first attempt to draw nearer in their economic relations had failed for the time being, there were other straws in the wind. On March 10, 1939, Stalin made a long speech at the first session of the 18th Party Congress in Moscow. 3 days later, the attentive Schulenburg filed a long report on it to Berlin. He thought it noteworthy that Stalin's irony and criticism were directed in considerably sharper degree against Britain than against the so-called aggressor states, and in particular Germany. The ambassador underlined Stalin's remarks that the weakness of the democratic powers was evident from the fact that they had abandoned the principle of collective security and had turned to a policy of non-intervention and neutrality. Underlying this policy was the wish to divert the aggressor states to other victims. And he quoted further the Soviet dictator's accusations that the Western Allies were pushing the Germans further eastward, promising them an easy prey and saying, "Just start a war with the Bolsheviks, everything else will take care of itself." This looks very much like encouragement. It looks as if the purpose was to engender the fury of the Soviet Union against Germany and to provoke a conflict with Germany without apparent reasons. In conclusion, Stalin formulated the guiding principles. 1. To continue to pursue a policy of peace and consolidation of economic relations with all countries. 2. Not to let our country be drawn into conflict by warmongers, whose custom it is to let others pull their chestnuts out of the fire. This was a plain warning from the man who made all the ultimate decisions in Russia, that the Soviet Union did not intend to be maneuvered into a war with Nazi Germany in order to spare Britain and France, and if it was ignored in London, it was at least noticed in Berlin. Though an Associated Press dispatch from Moscow, published in the New York Times March 12th, reported that Stalin's condemnation of efforts to embroil Russia in a war with Germany had led to talk in diplomatic circles in Moscow of the possibility of a rapprochement between the Soviet Union and Germany, Sir William Seeds, the British ambassador, apparently did not participate in any such talk. In his dispatch reporting Stalin's speech, Seeds made no mention of such a possibility. One Western diplomat, Joseph E. Davies, former American ambassador in Moscow, who is now stationed in Brussels, did draw the proper conclusions from Stalin's speech. "It is a most significant statement," he noted in his diary on March 11th. "It bears the earmarks of a definite warning to the British and French governments that the Soviets are getting tired of non-realistic opposition to the aggressors. This is really ominous for the negotiations between the British Foreign Office and the Soviet Union. It certainly is the most significant danger signal that I have yet seen." On March 21st, he wrote to Senator Key Pitman, "Hitler is making a desperate effort to alienate Stalin from France and Britain. Unless the British and French wake up, I'm afraid he will succeed." Still, it is evident from Stalin's speech and from the various diplomatic exchanges which shortly took place that Soviet foreign policy, while cautious, was still very much open. 3 days after the Nazi occupation of Czechoslovakia, on March 15th, the Russian government proposed, as we have seen, a six-power conference to discuss means of preventing further aggression, and Chamberlain turned it down as premature. In explaining to the Soviet ambassador in London, Ivan Maisky, on March 19th, why the Russian proposal for a conference, preferably at Bucharest, was not acceptable, Lord Halifax said that no minister of the Crown could be spared for the moment to go to Bucharest. It is obvious that this rebuff soured the Russians in the subsequent negotiations with the British and French. Maisky later told Robert Boothby, a conservative MP, that the rejection of the Russian proposal had been another smashing blow at the policy of effective collective security, and that it had decided the fate of Litvinov. That was on March 18th. 2 days later, an official communique in Moscow, which the German ambassador there hurriedly wired to Berlin, denied that the Soviet Union had offered Poland and Romania assistance in the event of their becoming the victims of aggression. Reason? Neither Poland nor Romania had approached the Soviet government for assistance or informed it of any danger threatening them. The British government's unilateral guarantee of Poland of March 31st may have helped to convince Stalin that Great Britain preferred an alliance with the Poles to one with the Russians, and that Chamberlain was intent, as he had been at the time of Munich, on keeping the Soviet Union out of the European concert of powers. In this situation, the Germans and Italians began to glimpse certain opportunities. Goering, who now had an important influence on Hitler in foreign affairs, saw Mussolini in Rome on April 16th and called the Duce's attention to Stalin's recent speech to the Communist Party Congress. He had been impressed by the Soviet dictator's statement that the Russians would not allow themselves to be used as cannon fodder for the capitalist powers. He said he would ask the Führer whether it would not be possible to put out feelers cautiously to Russia with a view to rapprochement. And he reminded Mussolini that there had been absolutely no mention of Russia in the Führer's latest speeches. The Duce, according to the confidential German memorandum of the meeting, warmly welcomed the idea of a rapprochement of the Axis powers with the Soviet Union. The Italian dictator, too, had sensed a change in Moscow. He thought a rapprochement could be effected with comparative ease. "The object," said Mussolini, "would be to induce Russia to react coolly and unfavorably to Britain's efforts at encirclement, on the lines of Stalin's speech. Moreover, in their ideological struggle against plutocracy and capitalism, the The Axis powers had, to a certain extent, the same objectives as the Russian regime. This was a radical turn in Axis policy, and no doubt it would have surprised Chamberlain had he learned of it. Perhaps it would have surprised Litvinov, too. On the very day of this discussion between Goering and Mussolini, April 16th, the Soviet Foreign Commissar received the British ambassador in Moscow and made a formal proposal for a triple pact of mutual assistance between Great Britain, France, and the Soviet Union. It called for a military convention between the three powers to enforce the pact, and a guarantee by the signatories, to be joined by Poland, if it desired, of all the nations in Central and Eastern Europe which felt themselves menaced by Nazi Germany. It was Litvinov's last bid for an alliance against the Third Reich, and the Russian foreign minister, who had staked his career on a policy of stopping Hitler by collective action, must have thought that at last he would succeed in uniting the Western democracies with Russia for that purpose. As Churchill said in a speech on May 4th, complaining that the Russian offer had not yet been accepted in London, "There is no means of maintaining an Eastern front against Nazi aggression without the active aid of Russia." No other power in Eastern Europe, certainly not Poland, possessed the military strength to maintain a front in that region. Yet the Russian proposal caused consternation in London and Paris. Even before it was rejected, however, Stalin made his first serious move to play the other side of the street. The day after Litvinov made his far-reaching offer to the British ambassador in Moscow, on April 17th, the Soviet ambassador in Berlin paid a visit to Weizsäcker at the German Foreign Office. It was the first call, the State Secretary noted in a memorandum, that Merikalov had made on him since he assumed his post nearly a year before. After some preliminary remarks about German-Russian economic relations, the ambassador turned to politics and asked me point-blank, Weizsäcker wrote, what I thought of German-Russian relations. The ambassador spoke somewhat as follows. Russian policy had always followed a straight course. Ideological differences had had very little adverse effect on relations between Russia and Italy, and need not disturb those with Germany either. Russia had not exploited the present friction between Germany and the Western democracies against us. Neither did she wish to do that. As far as Russia was concerned, there was no reason why she should not live on a normal footing with us. And out of normal relations could grow increasingly improved relations. With this remark, toward which he had been steering the conversation, Monsieur Merikalov ended the talk. He intends to visit Moscow in a day or two. In the Russian capital, to which the Soviet ambassador returned, there was something up. It came out on May 3rd. On that date, tucked away on the back page of the Soviet newspapers in a column called News in Brief, appeared a small item. Monsieur Litvinov has been released from the office of Foreign Commissar at his own request. He was replaced by Vyacheslav Molotov, chairman of the Council of the People's Commissars. The German chargé d'affaires reported the change to Berlin the next day. The sudden change has caused the greatest surprise here, as Litvinov was in the midst of negotiations with the British delegation, had appeared in close proximity to Stalin at the parade on May 1st. Since Litvinov had received the British ambassador as recently as May 2nd, and had even been mentioned in the press yesterday as a guest of honor at the parade, it seems that his dismissal must be due to a spontaneous decision by Stalin. At the last party congress, Stalin urged caution lest the Soviet Union be dragged into conflicts. Molotov, who is not a Jew, has the reputation of being the most intimate friend and closest collaborator of Stalin. His appointment is obviously intended to provide a guarantee that foreign policy will be conducted strictly on lines laid down by Stalin. The significance of Litvinov's abrupt dismissal was obvious to all. It meant a sharp and violent turning in Soviet foreign policy. Litvinov had been the arch-apostle of collective security, of strengthening the power of the League of Nations, of seeking Russian security against Nazi Germany by a military alliance with Great Britain and France. Chamberlain's hesitations about such an alliance were fatal to the Russian foreign commissar. In Stalin's judgment, and his was the only one which counted in Moscow, Litvinov's policies had failed. Moreover, they threatened to land the Soviet Union in a war with Germany which the Western democracies might well contrive to stay out of. it was time Stalin concluded to try a new tack. If some credence can be cautiously given to the published Journal of Litvinov, Notes for a Journal, Stalin had been contemplating such a change since Munich, from which the Soviet Union had been excluded. Toward the end of 1938, according to an entry in this journal, Stalin told Litvinov that "we are prepared to come to an agreement with the Germans, and also to render Poland harmless." In January 1939, the foreign commissar noted, "It would appear they have decided to remove me." In the same entry, he reveals that all his communications with the Soviet embassy in Berlin must now go through Stalin, and that Ambassador Mirakolov, on Stalin's instructions, is about to begin negotiations with Weizsäcker in order to let Hitler know, in effect, "we couldn't come to an agreement until now, but now we can." The journal is a somewhat dubious book. Professor Edward Hallett Carr, a British authority on the Soviet Union, investigated it and found that, though undoubtedly it had been touched up to a point where some of it was pure fiction, a large part of it fairly represents Litvinov's outlook. If Chamberlain could appease Hitler, could not the Russian dictator? The fact that Litvinov, a Jew, was replaced by Molotov, who, as the German embassy had emphasized in its dispatch to Berlin, was not, might be expected to have a certain impact in high Nazi circles. To see that the significance of the change was not lost on the Germans, Georgi Astakov, the Soviet chargé d'affaires, brought the matter up on May 5th when he conferred with Dr. Julius Schnurre, the German Foreign Office expert on East European economic affairs. Astakov touched upon the dismissal of Litvinov, Schnurre reported, and tried to learn whether this event would cause a change in our attitude toward the Soviet Union. He stressed the great importance of the personality of Molotov, who was by no means a specialist in foreign policy, but who would have all the greater importance for future Soviet foreign policy. The chargé also invited the Germans to resume the trade negotiations which had been broken off in February. The British government did not reply until May 8th to the Soviet proposals of April 16th for a military alliance. The response was a virtual rejection. It strengthened suspicions in Moscow that Chamberlain was not willing to make a military pact with Russia to prevent Hitler from taking Poland. It is not surprising, then, that the Russians intensified their approach to the Germans. On May 17th, Astakov again saw Schnurre at the Foreign Office and, after discussing problems of trade, turned to larger matters. Astakov stated, Schnurre reported, that there were no conflicts in foreign policy between Germany and the Soviet Union, and that therefore there was no reason for any enmity between the two countries. It was true that in the Soviet Union there was a distinct feeling of being menaced by Germany. It would undoubtedly be possible to eliminate this feeling of being menaced and the distrust in Moscow. In reply to my incidental question, he commented on the Anglo-Soviet negotiations to the effect that, as they stood at the moment, the result desired by Britain would hardly materialize. 3 days later, on May 20th, Ambassador von der Schulenburg had a long talk with Molotov in Moscow. The newly appointed Commissar for Foreign Affairs was in a most friendly mood and informed the German envoy that economic negotiations between the two countries could be resumed if the necessary political bases for them were created. This was a new approach from the Kremlin, but it was made cautiously by the cagey Molotov. When Schulenburg asked him what he meant by political bases, the Russian replied that this was something both governments would have to think about. All the ambassador's efforts to draw out the wily foreign commissar were in vain. "He is known," Schulenburg reminded Berlin, "for his somewhat stubborn manner." On his way out of the Russian Foreign Office, the ambassador dropped in on Vladimir Potemkin, the Soviet deputy commissar for foreign affairs, and told him he had not been able to find out what Molotov wanted of a political nature. "I asked Herr Potemkin," Schulenburg reported, "to find out." The renewed contacts between Berlin and Moscow did not escape the watchful eyes of the French ambassador in the German capital. As early as May 7th, 4 days after Litvinov's dismissal, Monsieur Coulondre was informing the French foreign minister that, according to information given him by a close confidant of the Führer, Germany was seeking an understanding with Russia which would result in, among other things, a fourth partition of Poland. 2 days later, the French ambassador got off another telegram to Paris telling of new rumors in Berlin that Germany had made or was going to make to Russia proposals aimed at a partition of Poland. The Pact of Steel. Although the top brass of the Wehrmacht had a low opinion of Italian military power, Hitler now pressed for a military alliance with Italy, which Mussolini had been in no hurry to conclude. Staff talks between the two high commands began in April, and Keitel reported to OKW his impression that neither the Italian fighting services nor Italian rearmament were in very good shape. A war, he thought, would have to be decided quickly, or the Italians would be out of it. By mid-April, as his diary shows, Ciano was alarmed by increasing signs that Germany might attack Poland at any moment and precipitate a European war for which Italy was not prepared. When, on April 20th, Ambassador Attolico in Berlin wired Rohn that German action against Poland was imminent, Ciano urged him to hasten arrangements for his meeting with Ribbentrop so that Italy would not be caught napping. The two foreign ministers met at Milan on May 6th. Ciano had arrived with written instructions from Mussolini to emphasize to the Germans that Italy wished to avoid war for at least 3 years. To the Italians' surprise, Ribbentrop agreed that Germany wished to keep the peace for that long, too. In fact, Ciano found the German foreign minister for the first time in a pleasantly calm state of mind. They reviewed the situation in Europe, agreed on improving Axis relations with the Soviet Union, and adjourned for a gala dinner. When, after dinner, Mussolini telephoned to see how the talks had gone, and Ciano replied that they had gone well, the Duce had a sudden brainstorm. He asked his son-in-law to release to the press a communique saying that Germany and Italy had decided to conclude a military alliance. Ribbentrop at first hesitated. He finally agreed to put the matter up to Hitler, and the Führer, when reached by telephone, readily agreed to Mussolini's suggestion. Thus, on a sudden impulse, after more than a year of hesitation, Mussolini committed himself irrevocably to Hitler's fortunes. This was one of the first signs that the Italian dictator, like the German, was beginning to lose that iron self-control which, up until this year of 1939, had enabled them both to pursue their own national interests with ice-cold clarity. The consequences for Mussolini would soon prove disastrous. The Pact of Steel, as it came to be known, was duly signed with considerable pomp at the Reich Chancellery in Berlin on May 22nd. Ciano had bestowed on Ribbentrop the collar of the Annunciata, which not only made Göring furious, but, as the Italian foreign minister noticed, brought tears to his eyes. In fact, the plump field marshal had made quite a scene, complaining that the collar really should have been awarded to him, since it was he who had really promoted the alliance. "I promised Mackensen," the German ambassador in Rome, Ciano reported, "that I would try to get Göring a collar." Ciano found Hitler looking very well, quite serene, less aggressive, though he seemed a little older and his eyes more deeply wrinkled, probably from lack of sleep. Ciano's diary from May 22nd is full of titbits about Hitler and his weird entourage. Frau Goebbels complained that the Führer kept his friends up all night and exclaimed, "It is always Hitler who talks. He repeats himself and bores his guests." Ciano also heard hints of the Führer's tender feelings for a beautiful girl. "She is 20 years old, with beautiful quiet eyes, regular features, and a magnificent body. Her name is Sigrid von Lapus. They see each other frequently and intimately." The Ciano Diaries, page 85. Ciano, a great man with the ladies himself, was obviously intrigued. Apparently he had not yet heard of Eva Braun, Hitler's mistress, who was rarely permitted at this time to come to Berlin. The Führer was in the best of spirits as he watched the two foreign ministers sign the document. It was a bluntly worded military alliance, and its aggressive nature was underlined by a sentence in the preamble which Hitler had insisted on putting in, declaring that the two nations, united by the inner affinity of their ideologies, are resolved to act side by side and with united forces to secure their living space. The core of the treaty was Article 3. "If contrary to the wishes and hopes of the high contracting parties, it should happen that one of them became involved in warlike complications with another power or powers, the other high contracting party would immediately come to its assistance as an ally, and support it with all its military forces on land, at sea, and in the air. Article 5 provided that in the event of war, neither nation would conclude a separate armistice or peace. In the beginning, as it would turn out, Mussolini did not honor the first, nor at the end did Italy abide by the second. Hitler burns his boats, May 23, 1939. The day after the signing of the Pact of Steel, on May 23, Hitler summoned his military chiefs to the study in the Chancellery in Berlin and told them bluntly that further successes could not be won without the shedding of blood, and that war, therefore, was inevitable. This was a somewhat larger gathering than a similar one on November 5, 1937, when the Führer had first imparted his decision to go to war to the commanders-in-chief of the three armed services. Altogether, 14 officers were present, including Field Marshal Goering, Grand Admiral Raeder, as he now was, General von Brauchitsch, General Halder, General Keitel, General Erhard Milch, Inspector General of the Luftwaffe, and Rear Admiral Otto Schneewind, Naval Chief of Staff. The Führer's adjutant, Lieutenant Colonel Rudolf Schmundt, was also present and, luckily for history, took notes. His minutes of the meeting are among the captured German documents. Apparently Hitler's words on this occasion were regarded as such a top secret that no copies of the minutes were made. The one we have is in Schmundt's own handwriting. It is one of the most revealing and important of the secret papers which depict Hitler's road to war. Here, before the handful of men who will have to direct the military forces in an armed conflict, Hitler cuts through his own propaganda and diplomatic deceit and utters the truth about why he must attack Poland, and, if necessary, take on Great Britain and France as well. He predicts with uncanny accuracy the course the war will take, at least in its first year. And yet, for all its bluntness, his discourse, for the dictator did all the talking, discloses more uncertainty and confusion of mind than he has shown up to this point. Above all, Britain and the British continue to baffle him, as they did to the end of his life. But about the coming of war and his aims in launching it, he is clear and precise, and no general or admiral could have left the Chancellery on May 23rd without knowing exactly what was coming at the summer's end. Germany's economic problems, he began, could only be solved by obtaining more Lebensraum in Europe, and this is impossible without invading other countries or attacking other people's possessions. Further successes can no longer be attained without the shedding of blood. Danzig is not the subject of the dispute at all. It is a question of expanding our living space in the East, of securing our food supplies, and also of solving the problem of the Baltic states. There is no other possibility in Europe. If fate forces us into a showdown with the West, it is invaluable to possess a large area in the East. In wartime, we shall be even less able to rely on record harvests than in peacetime. Besides, Hitler adds, the population of non-German territories in the East will be available as a source of labor, an early hint of the slave labor program he was later to put into effect. The choice of the first victim was obvious. There is no question of sparing Poland, and we are left with the decision to attack Poland at the first suitable opportunity. We cannot expect a repetition of the Czech affair. There will be war. Our task is to isolate Poland. Success in isolating her will be decisive. So, there will be war. With an isolated Poland alone? Here the Führer is not so clear. In fact, he becomes confused and contradictory. He must reserve to himself, he says, the final order to strike. It must not come to a simultaneous showdown with the West, France, and England. If it is not certain that a German-Polish conflict will not lead to war with the West, then the fight must be primarily against England and France. Fundamentally, therefore, conflict with Poland, beginning with an attack on Poland, will only be successful if the West keeps out of it. If that is not possible, it is better to fall upon the West and to finish off Poland at the same time. In the face of such rapid-fire contradictions, the generals must have winced, perhaps prying their monocles loose, though there is no evidence in the Schmundt minutes that this happened or that anyone in the select audience even dared to ask a question to straighten matters out. Hitler next turned to Russia. It is not ruled out, he said, that Russia might disinterest herself in the destruction of Poland. On the other hand, if the Soviet Union allied herself to Britain and France, that would lead me to attack England and France with a few devastating blows. That would mean committing the same mistake Wilhelm II made in 1914. But though in this lecture Hitler drew several lessons from the World War, he did not draw this one. His thoughts now turned toward Great Britain. The Führer doubts the possibility of a peaceful settlement with England. It is necessary to be prepared for the showdown. England sees in our development the establishment of a hegemony which would weaken England. Therefore, England is our enemy, and the conflict with England is a matter of life and death. What will this conflict be like? England cannot finish off Germany with a few powerful blows and force us down. It is of decisive importance for England to carry the war as near as possible to the Ruhr. French blood will not be spared. West Wall! The duration of our existence is dependent on possession of the Ruhr. Having decided to follow the Kaiser in one mistake, attacking France and England if they lined up with Russia, Hitler now announced that he would follow the Emperor in another matter which eventually had proved disastrous to Germany. The Dutch and Belgian air bases must be militarily occupied. Declarations of neutrality can be ignored. If England wants to intervene in the Polish War, we must make a lightning attack on Holland. We must aim at establishing a new line of defense on Dutch territory as far as the Zuider Zee. The war with England and France will be a war of life and death. The idea that we can get off cheaply is dangerous. There is no such possibility. We must then burn our boats, and it will no longer be a question of right or wrong, but of to be or not to be for 80 million people. Though he had just announced that Germany would attack Poland at the first suitable opportunity, and though his listeners knew that almost all of Germany's military strength was being concentrated on that objective, Hitler, as he rambled on, could not keep his thoughts off Great Britain. England, he emphasized, is the driving force against Germany, whereupon he discussed her strengths and weaknesses. The Britisher himself is proud, brave, tough, dogged, and a gifted organizer. He knows how to exploit every new development. He has the love of adventure and the courage of the Nordic race. England is a world power in herself, constant for 300 years, increased by alliances. This power is not only something concrete, but must also be considered a psychological force, embracing the entire world. Add to this immeasurable wealth and the solvency that goes with it. Geopolitical security and protection by a strong sea power and courageous air force. But Britain, Hitler reminded his hearers, also had her weaknesses, and he proceeded to enumerate them. If in the last war we had had 2 more battleships and 2 more cruisers, and had begun the Battle of Jutland in the morning, the British fleet would have been defeated and England brought to her knees. Hitler's understanding of the Battle of Jutland was obviously faulty. It would have meant the end of the World War. In former times, to conquer England, it was necessary to invade her. England could feed herself. Today, she no longer can. The moment England is cut off from her supplies, she is forced to capitulate. Imports of food and fuel oil are dependent on naval protection. Luftwaffe attacks on England will not force her to capitulate. But if the fleet is annihilated, instant capitulation results. There is no doubt that a surprise attack might lead to a quick decision. A surprise attack with what? Surely Admiral Raeder must have thought that Hitler was talking through his hat. Under the so-called Z plan, promulgated at the end of 1938, German naval strength would only begin to approach that of the British by 1945. At the moment, in the spring of 1939, Germany did not have the heavy ships to sink the British Navy, even by a surprise attack. Perhaps Britain could be brought down by other means. Here Hitler came down to earth again and outlined a strategic plan, which a year later, in fact, would be carried out with amazing success. The aim must be to deal the enemy a smashing or a finally decisive blow right at the start. Considerations of right or wrong or of treaties do not enter into the matter. This will be possible only when we do not slide into a war with England on account of Poland. Preparations must be made for a long war as well as for a surprise attack, and every possible intervention by England on the continent must be smashed. The army must occupy the positions important for the fleet and the Luftwaffe. if we succeed in occupying and securing Holland and Belgium, as well as defeating France, the basis for a successful war against England has been created. The Luftwaffe can then closely blockade England from western France, and the fleet undertake the wider blockade with submarines. That is precisely what would be done a little more than a year later. Another decisive strategic plan, which the Führer emphasized on May 23rd, would also be carried out. At the beginning of the last war, had the German army executed a wheeling movement toward the Channel ports instead of toward Paris, the end, he said, would have been different. Perhaps it would have been. At any rate, he would try it in 1940. The aim, Hitler concluded, apparently forgetting all about Poland for the moment, will always be to force England to her knees. There was one final consideration. Secrecy is the decisive prerequisite for success. Our objectives must be kept secret from both Italy and Japan. Even Hitler's own Army General Staff, whose chief, General Halder, sat there listening, was not to be trusted entirely. Our studies, the Führer laid down, must not be left to the General Staff. Secrecy would then no longer be assured. He ordered that a small planning staff in OKW be set up to work out the military plans. On May 23, 1939, then, Hitler, as he himself said, burned his boats. There would be war. Germany needed Lebensraum in the east. To get at Poland would be attacked at the first opportunity. Danzig had nothing to do with it. That was merely an excuse. Britain stood in the way. She was the real driving force against Germany. Very well, she would be taken on too, and France. It would be a life-and-death struggle. When the Führer had first outlined his plans for aggression to the military chiefs on November 5, 1937, Field Marshal von Blomberg and General von Fritsch had protested, at least on the grounds that Germany was too weak to fight a European war. During the following summer, General Beck had resigned as Chief of the Army General Staff for the same reason. But on May 23, 1939, not a single general or admiral, so far as the record shows, raised his voice to question the wisdom of Hitler's course. Their job, as they saw it, was not to question, but to blindly obey. Already they had been applying their considerable talents to working out plans for military aggression. On May 7th, Colonel Günter Blumentritt of the Army General Staff, who with Generals von Rundstedt and von Manstein formed a small working staff, submitted an estimate of the situation for Case White. Actually, it was a plan for the conquest of Poland. It was an imaginative and daring plan, and it would be followed with very few changes. Admiral Raeder came through with naval plans for Case White in a top-secret directive signed May 16th. Since Poland had only a few miles of coast on the Baltic west of Danzig and possessed only a small navy, no difficulties were expected. France and Britain were the admiral's chief concern. The entrance to the Baltic was to be protected by submarines, and the two pocket battleships and the two battleships, with the remaining submarines, were to prepare for war in the Atlantic. According to the instructions of the Führer, the Navy had to be prepared to carry out its part of White by September 1st, but Raeder urged his commanders to hasten plans because, due to the latest political developments, action might come sooner. As May 1939 came to an end, German preparations for going to war by the end of the summer were well along. The great armament works were humming, turning out guns, tanks, planes, and warships. The able staffs of the Army, Navy, and Air Force had reached the final stage of planning. The ranks were being swelled by new men called up for summer training. Hitler could be pleased with what he had accomplished. The day after the Führer's lecture to the military chiefs, on May 24th, General Georg Thomas, head of the Economic and Armaments Branch of OKW, summed up that accomplishment in a confidential lecture to the staff of the Foreign Office. Whereas it had taken the Imperial Army, Thomas reminded his listeners, 16 years, from 1898 to 1914, to increase its strength from 43 to 50 divisions, the Army of the Third Reich had jumped from 7 to 51 divisions in just 4 years. Among them were 5 heavy armored divisions and 4 light ones, a modern battle cavalry such as no other nation possessed. The Navy had built up from practically nothing a fleet of 2 battleships of 26,000 tons, two heavy cruisers, 17 destroyers, and 47 submarines. It had already launched two battleships of 35,000 tons, one aircraft carrier, four heavy cruisers, five destroyers, and seven submarines, and was planning to launch a great many more ships. In giving these tonnages for German battleships, General Thomas was deceiving even the Foreign Office. An interesting German naval document dated more than a year before, February 18, 1938, notes that false figures on battleship tonnage had been furnished the British government under the Anglo-German Naval Agreement. It states that the actual tonnage of the 26,000-ton ships was 31,300 tons. That of the 35,000-ton battleships, the top level in the British and American navies, was actually 41,700 tons. It is a curious example of Nazi deceit. From absolutely nothing, the Luftwaffe had built up a force of 21 squadrons with a personnel of 260,000 men. The armament industry, General Thomas said, was already producing more than it had during the peak of the last war, and its output in most fields far exceeded that of any other country. In fact, total German rearmament, the general declared, was probably unique in the world. Formidable as German military power was becoming at the beginning of the summer of 1939, the prospect of success in the war which Hitler was planning for the early fall depended on what kind of war it was. Germany was still not strong enough, and probably would never be, to take on France, Britain, and Russia in addition to Poland. As the fateful summer commenced, all depended on the Führer's ability to limit the war, above all, to keep Russia from forming the military alliance with the West which Litvinov, just before his fall, had proposed, and which Chamberlain, though he had at first seemed to reject it, was, by May's end, again mulling over. The Intervention of Russia. 2. In a debate in the House of Commons on May 19th, the British Prime Minister had again taken a cool and even disdainful view, as Churchill thought, of the Russian proposals. Somewhat wearily, he had explained to the House that there is a sort of veil, a sort of wall between the two governments, which it is extremely difficult to penetrate. Churchill, on the other hand, backed by Lloyd George, argued that Moscow had made a fair offer, more simple, more direct, more effective than Chamberlain's own proposals. He begged His Majesty's government to get some brutal truths into their heads. Without an effective Eastern Front, there can be no satisfactory defense in the West, and without Russia, there can be no effective Eastern Front. Bowing to the storm of criticism from all sides, Chamberlain, on May 27th, finally instructed the British ambassador in Moscow to agree to begin discussions of a pact of mutual assistance, a military convention, and guarantees to the countries threatened by Hitler. On May 27th, the British ambassador and the French chargé d'affaires in Moscow presented Molotov with an Anglo-French draft of the proposed pact. To the surprise of the Western envoys, Molotov took a very cool view of it. Ambassador von Dirksen in London advised the German Foreign Office that the British government had taken the step with the greatest reluctance. Furthermore, Dirksen divulged what was perhaps the primary reason for Chamberlain's move. The British Foreign Office, he reported urgently to Berlin, had got wind of German feelers in Moscow and was afraid that Germany might succeed in keeping Soviet Russia neutral or even inducing her to adopt benevolent neutrality. That would have meant the complete collapse of the encirclement action. On the last day of May, Molotov made his first public speech as Commissar for Foreign Affairs in an address to the Supreme Council of the USSR. He castigated the Western democracies for their hesitation and declared that if they were serious in joining Russia to stop aggression, they must get down to brass tacks and come to an agreement on three main points. 1. Conclude a tripartite mutual assistance pact of a purely defensive character. 2. Guarantee the states of Central and Eastern Europe, including all European states bordering on the Soviet Union. 3. Conclude a definite agreement on the form and scope of the immediate and effective aid to be afforded each other and the smaller states threatened by aggression. Molotov also declared that the talks with the West did not mean that Russia would forego business relations on a practical footing with Germany and Italy. In fact, He said that it was not out of the question that commercial negotiations with Germany could be resumed. Ambassador von der Schulenburg, in reporting the speech to Berlin, pointed out that Molotov had indicated that Russia was still prepared to conclude a treaty with Britain and France on condition that all her demands are accepted, but that it was now evident from the address that it would take a long time before any real agreement was reached. He pointed out that Molotov had avoided sallies against Germany and showed readiness to continue the talks begun in Berlin and Moscow. This readiness was now suddenly shared by Hitler in Berlin. During the last 10 days of May, Hitler and his advisers blew hot and cold over the thorny question of making advances to Moscow in order to thwart the Anglo-Russian negotiations. It was felt in Berlin that Molotov, in his talk with Ambassador von der Schulenburg on May 20th, had thrown cold water on Germany's approaches, and on the following day, May 21st, Weizsäcker wired the ambassador that in view of what the foreign commissar had said, we must now sit tight and wait to see if the Russians will speak more openly. But Hitler, having fixed September 1st for his attack on Poland, could not afford to sit tight. On or about May 25th, Weizsäcker and Friedrich Gauss, director of the legal department of the German Foreign Office, were summoned to Ribbentrop's country house at Sonnenburg, and according to Gauss's affidavit submitted at Nuremberg, informed that the Führer wanted to establish more tolerable relations between Germany and the Soviet Union. The affidavit was rejected as evidence by the tribunal and is not published in the Nazi Conspiracy and Aggression, or Trial of the Major War Criminals volumes of the Nuremberg Evidence. This does not detract from its authenticity. All material dealing with Nazi-Soviet collaboration during this period was handled gingerly by the tribunal, one of whose 4 judges was a Russian. Draft instructions to Schulenburg were drawn up by Ribbentrop, outlining in considerable detail the new line he was to take with Molotov, whom he was asked to see as soon as possible. This draft is among the captured German Foreign Office documents. It was shown to Hitler, according to a notation on the document, on May 26th. It is a revealing paper. It discloses that by this date the German Foreign Office was convinced that the Anglo-Russian negotiations would be successfully concluded unless Germany intervened decisively. Ribbentrop therefore proposed that Schulenburg tell Molotov the following. A real opposition of interests in foreign affairs does not exist between Germany and Soviet Russia. The time has come to consider a pacification and normalization of German-Soviet-Russian foreign relations. The Italo-German alliance is not directed against the Soviet Union. It is exclusively directed against the Anglo-French combination. If, against our wishes, it should come to hostilities with Poland, we are firmly convinced that even this need not in any way lead to a clash of interests with Soviet Russia. We can even go so far as to say that when settling the German-Polish question, in whatever way this is done, we would take Russian interests into account as far as possible. Next, the danger to Russia of an alliance with Great Britain was to be pointed up. We are unable to see what could really induce the Soviet Union to play an active part in the game of the British policy of encirclement. This would mean Russia undertaking a one-sided liability without any really valuable British quid pro quo. Britain is by no means in a position to offer Russia a really valuable quid pro quo, no matter how the treaties may be formulated. All assistance in Europe is rendered impossible by the West Wall. We are therefore convinced that Britain will once more remain faithful to her traditional policy of letting other powers pull her chestnuts out of the fire. Schulenburg also was to emphasize that Germany had no aggressive intentions against Russia. Finally, he was instructed to tell Molotov that Germany was ready to discuss with the Soviet Union not only economic questions, but a return to normal in political relations. Hitler thought the draft went too far and ordered it held up. The Führer, according to Gauss, had been impressed by Chamberlain's optimistic statement of 2 days before, May 24th, when the Prime Minister had told the House of Commons that as the result of new British proposals, he hoped that full agreement with Russia could be reached at an early date. What Hitler feared was a rebuff. He did not abandon the idea of a rapprochement with Moscow, but decided that for the time being a more cautious approach would be best. The backing and filling which took place in the Führer's mind during the last week of May is documented in the captured German Foreign Office papers. On or about the 25th, the exact day is not quite certain, he had suddenly come out for pushing talks with the Soviet Union in order to thwart the Anglo-Russian negotiations. Schulenburg was to see Molotov at once for that purpose. But Ribbentrop's instructions to him, which were shown Hitler on the 26th, were never sent. The Führer cancelled them. That evening, Weizsäcker wired Schulenburg advising him to maintain an attitude of complete reserve. You personally should not make any move until further notice. This telegram and a letter which the State Secretary wrote the ambassador in Moscow on May 27th but did not mail until May 30th, when a significant postscript was added, go far to explaining the hesitations in Berlin. Weizsäcker, writing on the 27th, informed Schulenburg that it was the opinion in Berlin that an Anglo-Russian agreement would not be easy to prevent, and that Germany hesitated to intervene decisively against it for fear of provoking a peal of Tartar laughter in Moscow. Also, the State Secretary revealed, both Japan and Italy had been cool toward Germany's proposed move in Moscow, and the reserve of her allies had helped to influence the decision in Berlin to sit tight. Thus, he concluded, we now want to wait and see how deeply Moscow and Paris-London mutually engage themselves. For some reason, Weizsäcker did not post his letter at once. Perhaps he felt that Hitler had not yet fully made up his mind. When he did mail it on May 30th, he added a postscript. P.S. To my above lines, I must add that, with the approval of the Führer, an approach is nonetheless now to be made to the Russians, though a very much modified one, and this by means of a conversation which I am to hold today with the Russian chargé d'affaires. This talk with Georgi Astakov did not get very far, but it represented for the Germans a new start. Weizsäcker's pretext for calling in the Russian chargé was to discuss the future of the Soviet trade delegation in Prague, which the Russians were anxious to maintain. Around this subject, the two diplomats sparred to find out what was in each other's mind. Weizsäcker said he agreed with Molotov that political and economic questions could not be entirely separated, and expressed interest in the normalization of relations between Soviet Russia and Germany. Astakov asserted that Molotov had no intention of barring the door against further Russo-German discussions. Cautious as both men were, the Germans were encouraged. At 10:40 o'clock that evening of May 30th, Weizsäcker got off a most urgent telegram to Schulenburg in Moscow. Contrary to the tactics hitherto planned, we have now, after all, decided to make a certain degree of contact with the Soviet Union. In Nazi-Soviet Relations, a volume of German Foreign Office documents on that subject published by the U.S. State Department in 1949, the English translation of the telegram came out much stronger. The key sentence was given as, "We have now decided to undertake definite negotiations with the Soviet Union." This has led many historians, including Churchill, to conclude that this telegram of May 30th marked the decisive turning point in Hitler's efforts to make a deal with Moscow. That turning point came later. As Weizsäcker pointed out in the May 30th postscript to his letter to Schulenburg, the German approach, which Hitler had approved, was to be a very much modified one. It may have been that a long secret memorandum which Mussolini penned to Hitler on May 30th strengthened the Führer's resolve to turn to the Soviet Union, however cautiously. As the summer commenced, the Duce's doubts mounted as to the advisability of an early conflict. He was convinced, he wrote Hitler, that war between the plutocratic self-seeking conservative nations and the Axis was inevitable. But Italy requires a period of preparation which may extend until the end of 1942. Only from 1943 onward will an effort by war have the greatest prospects of success. After enumerating several reasons why Italy needs a period of peace, the Duce concluded, for all these reasons, Italy does not wish to hasten a European war, although she is convinced of the inevitability of such a war. Hitler, who had not taken his good friend and ally into his confidence about the date of September 1st, which he had set for attacking Poland, replied that he had read the secret memorandum with the greatest interest and suggested that the two leaders meet for discussions sometime in the future. In the meantime, the Führer decided to see if a crack could be made in the Kremlin wall. All through June, preliminary talks concerning a new trade agreement were held in Moscow between the German embassy and Anastas Mikoyan, the Russian Commissar for Foreign Trade. The Soviet government was still highly suspicious of Berlin. As Schulenburg reported toward the end of the month, June 27th, the Kremlin believed the Germans, in pressing for a trade agreement, wished to torpedo the Russian negotiations with Britain and France. "They are afraid," he wired Berlin, "that as soon as we have gained this advantage, we might let the negotiations peter out." On June 28th, Schulenburg had a long talk with Molotov, which proceeded, he told Berlin in a secret and urgent telegram, "in a friendly manner." Nevertheless, when the German ambassador referred assuringly to the non-aggression treaties which Germany had just concluded with the Baltic states, the Soviet foreign commissar tartly replied that he must doubt the permanence of such treaties after the experiences which Poland had had. To try to forestall an Anglo-French-Russian guarantee of Latvia and Estonia, which bordered on the Soviet Union, Germany had hastily signed non-aggression pacts with these two Baltic states on June 7th. Even before this, on May 31st, Germany had pushed through a similar pact with Denmark, which, considering recent events, appears to have given the Danes an astonishing sense of security. Summing up the talk, Schulenburg concluded, "My impression is that the Soviet government is greatly interested in learning our political views and in maintaining contact with us." Although there was no mistaking the strong distrust evident in all that Molotov said, he nevertheless described a normalization of relations with Germany as being desirable and possible. The ambassador requested telegraphic instructions as to his next move. Schulenburg was one of the last survivors of the Zeigt, Maltzahn, and Brockdorff-Rantzau school, which had insisted on a German rapprochement with Soviet Russia after 1919, and which had brought it about at Rapallo. As his dispatches throughout 1939 make clear, he sincerely sought to restore the close relations which had existed during the Weimar Republic. But like so many other German career diplomats of the old school, he little understood Hitler. Suddenly, on June 29th, Hitler, from his mountain retreat at Berchtesgaden, ordered the talks with the Russians broken off. Berchtesgaden, June 29th, 1939. The Führer has decided as follows. The Russians are to be informed that we have seen from their attitude that they are making the continuation of further talks dependent on the acceptance of the basis for our economic discussions as fixed in January. Since this basis was not acceptable to us, we would not be interested in a resumption of the economic discussions with Russia at present. The Führer has agreed that this answer be delayed for a few days. Actually, the substance of it was telegraphed to the German embassy in Moscow the next day. The foreign minister, Weizsäcker wired, is of the opinion that in the political field enough has been said until further instructions, and that for the moment the talks should not be taken up again by us. Concerning the possible economic negotiations with the Russian government, the deliberations here have not yet been concluded. In this field, too, you are requested for the time being to take no further action, but to await instructions. There is no clue in the secret German documents which explains Hitler's sudden change of mind. The Russians already had begun to compromise on their proposals of January and February. And Schnurre had warned on June 15th that a breakdown in the economic negotiations would be a setback for Germany both economically and politically. Nor could the rocky course of the Anglo-French-Soviet negotiations have so discouraged Hitler as to lead him to such a decision. He knew from the reports of the German embassy in Moscow that Russia and the Western powers were deadlocked over the question of guarantees to Poland, Romania, and the Baltic states. Poland and Romania were happy to be guaranteed by Britain and France, which could scarcely help them in the event of German aggression except by the indirect means of setting up a Western front. But they refused to accept a Russian guarantee or even to allow for Soviet troops to pass through their territories to meet a German attack. Latvia, Estonia, and Finland also stoutly declined to accept any Russian guarantee, an attitude which, as the German Foreign Office papers later revealed, was encouraged by Germany in the form of dire threats should they weaken in their resolve. In this impasse, Molotov suggested at the beginning of June that Great Britain send its foreign secretary to Moscow to take part in the negotiations. Apparently, in the Russian view, this would not only help to break the deadlock, but would show that Britain was in earnest in arriving at an agreement with Russia. Lord Halifax declined to go. According to the British Foreign Office papers, Halifax told Maisky on June 8th that he had thought of suggesting to the Prime Minister that he should go to Moscow, but it was really impossible to get away. Maisky, on June 12th, after Strang had left, suggested to Halifax that it would be a good idea for the Foreign Secretary to go to Moscow when things were quieter, but Halifax again stressed the impossibility of his being absent from London for the present. Anthony Eden, who was at least a former Foreign Secretary, offered to go in his place, but Chamberlain turned him down. It was decided instead to send William Strang, a capable career official in the Foreign Office who had previously served in the Moscow Embassy and spoke Russian, but was little known either in his own country or outside of it. The appointment of so subordinate an official to head such an important mission and to negotiate directly with Molotov and Stalin was a signal to the Russians, they later said, that Chamberlain still did not take very seriously the business of building an alliance to stop Hitler. Strang arrived in Moscow on June 14th, but though he participated in 11 Anglo-French meetings with Molotov, his appearance had little effect on the course of Anglo-Soviet negotiations. A fortnight later, on June 29th, Russian suspicion and irritation was publicly displayed in an article in Pravda by Andrei Zhdanov under the headline, "British and French Governments Do Not Want a Treaty on the Basis of Equality for the Soviet Union." Though purporting to write as a private individual and not committing the Soviet government, Zhdanov was not only a member of the Politburo and president of the Foreign Affairs Committee of the Soviet Parliament, but, as Schulenburg emphasized to Berlin in reporting on the matter, one of Stalin's confidants, whose article was doubtless written on orders from above. "It seems to me," Zhdanov wrote, "that the British and French governments are not out for a real agreement acceptable to the USSR, but only for talks about an agreement in order to demonstrate before the public opinion of their own countries the alleged unyielding attitude of the USSR, and thus facilitate the conclusion of an agreement with the aggressors. The next few days will show whether this is so or not." Stalin's distrust of Britain and France and his suspicion that the Western Allies might in the end make a deal with Hitler, as they had the year before at Munich, was thus publicized for all the world to ponder. Ambassador von der Schulenburg, pondering it, suggested to Berlin that one purpose of the article was to lay the blame on Britain and France for the possible breakdown of negotiations.